Jackson, W266, DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
AP News for Friday, December 2nd. I'm Ben Thomas. Western allies are closing ranks in an effort to starve Russia of funding for its war in Ukraine. Norman Hall has details.
The group of seven nations and Australia have joined the European Union to adopt a $60 per barrel price cap on Russian oil. Europe needed to set the discounted price by Monday when an EU embargo on Russian oil shipped by sea and a ban on insurance for those supplies take effect. The price cap aims to prevent a sudden loss of Russian oil to the world that could lead to a new surge in energy prices and further fuel inflation.
Democrats have voted to make South Carolina the leadoff state on their 2024 presidential nominating calendar. That would bump Iowa. President Biden has endorsed the move, saying it will better reflect the party's deeply diverse electorate. The full Democratic National Committee is expected to approve the change early next year. In economic news, Bankrate.com senior economic analyst Mark Hamrick on the November jobs report.
This is a better than expected jobs report, particularly when you look at the number of jobs added on the month, 263,000. The expectation was about 200,000 jobs added.
The unemployment rate held steady at 3.7%, but Hamrick says strong wage growth could be an issue for inflation hawks.
Our average hourly earnings are up 5.1% over the past year. The Federal Reserve looks at that and believes that it has more work to do with respect to interest rate increases. And of course, we have a Federal Reserve meeting looming in the middle part of the month, and there is the expectation we will have another rate increase then.
A jury in Los Angeles has begun deliberations in the rape trial of former movie mogul Harvey Weinstein. He could get more than 60 years in prison if convicted on all counts. And a new report finds South America's Amazon region lost 10% of its vegetation from 1985 to 2021, an area roughly the size of Texas. This is AP News.
Girls and boys in poverty around the world are dreaming of a better life, filled with dance, art, music, and knowledge. They dream of a brighter future with enough nutritious food to eat, chance to learn and grow, to get an education, escape poverty, and do incredible things. Today, thanks to Children International and friends like you, such dreams are coming true. Together, we give children a chance to set their sights high and succeed in school and in life by ensuring that they have access to healthcare, education, life skills, and so much more so they can grow, thrive, and believe in themselves. Learn more about Children International and join us in our life-changing work at children.org today. Together, we can help end poverty for good.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
I was about to get on the radio and be interviewed, and all of a sudden, I see something out of the corner of my eye move. It was a squirrel.
Oh, that's not good.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
I couldn't find the squirrel, but I knew it was somewhere in the house. I ended up naming him Albert. He was relocated to Brookfield, so he is now a suburban squirrel.
Listen to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry right here on the Shaw 101 FM and WAUK 540 AM.
We have to really understand how critically important a time this is. Time for talk is over. The time for action is now. Because my voice has always been and will continue to be for people who don't have a voice.
Tune in to the Earl Ingram Show every Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Only on WAUK 540 AM, 101.1 FM, The Shaw.
My Alzheimer's diagnosis was hard to take.
But early detection allowed us to take control of the situation. Together.
Talk to your family about seeing a doctor. Go to alz.org/time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
MyShiro always goes the extra mile, stretches every dollar, puts others first. But now it's your time, Mom. Get free tips to help boost your retirement savings now at aceyourretirement.org.
Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
If you can plan barbecues and weddings, you can plan to protect yourself from a natural disaster. Sign up for local alerts, prepare an emergency kit, and make a family communications plan. Get started at ready.gov/plan.
Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matner with your headlines. Wisconsin's Republican leaders don't want this spring's Supreme Court election to be focused on abortion. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporting GOP Assembly Speaker Robin Voss hoping the legislature will introduce amendments to Wisconsin's abortion ban or write a new law that will be signed by Governor Evers so the state Supreme Court doesn't have to weigh in. However, Governor Evers has said he will not sign a bill unless it codifies abortion rules in place under the 5 decades of Roe v. Wade. Under Roe, abortion was allowed until fetal viability, the point when a fetus can survive outside of the womb at about 24 weeks. The court currently controlled 4-3 by conservatives. The 2023 race could flip control to liberals. The primary February 21st, the two top finishers advanced to the April 4th general election. The new justice would take the bench in August. You're listening to The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK, 540 AM.
Show.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So here's the thing. I mean, the situation with Biden and the railroads, not historically unique. I mean, this has happened before. Last time, I believe, was 91 when George H.W. Bush took the right to strike away from the railroad workers. I got a couple of emails from people not thrilled with Bill Clinton over his involvement during one period of time. Again, I come back to, I think workers should have the right to strike regardless of the situation. Got to have the consequence. But, you know, a couple of people have asked about the railroad strike in 1946 and what that was like. And it made me think, hey, I should talk to my labor expert buddy. And that's why I've asked Eric Loomis to come talk with us. He has literally written the book on strikes, A History of America in 10 Strikes, a must read for all working people. Eric, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's start right from the beginning. This isn't historically unique, is it?
No, not at all. You know, the rail strikes, I mean, have played a really outsized role in American labor history. The railroad, of course, historically in the 19th century was the way to get around the country. And even though we often, you know, don't think about railroads as much these days, we think about planes and we think about trucks and other transportation networks. The rail still transports an enormous amount of goods around the country and is still an incredibly critically important part of our transportation system. And so because of that, the potential for rail strikes has led to government intervention and involvement many, many times through our history, some of which in the old days is among the most violent and horrible moments in American labor history. And in the last century or 90 years, really, has more been about a more moderate intervention that is intended to limit strikes, but also to a certain extent limit corporate behavior as well.
Yeah, now we've heard a lot here recently about the RLA, you know, the Railway Labor Act. A lot of people, you know, now finally hearing about it for the first time. And look, there are people saying there's some good things, there's some bad things. The good thing is it's a closed shop. You have to be a member, you know, that right to work nonsense. But this is part of the reason that we have Taft-Hartley. This is part of the reason that we've got that horrible labor law for the rest of us, because this was, you know, one of those strikes from 1946 where you know millions of workers were striking during that time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when we're thinking about what's going on today, you know, I think that what's really critically important here is, regardless of whether you approve of what Joe Biden did or disapprove of what Joe Biden did or has done, you have to put it in the context of the larger historical perspective here, which is that presidents have intervened in rail strikes for a very, very long time. And even those who we see as, you know, who many may see as like presidents who stood up for labor, have often been really terrible on the railway strike issue. As you mentioned, 1946 was the massive strike wave in America, and millions of workers go on strike that year. One of the largest was the railway strike. And President Harry Truman, who's often seen as one of those pro-labor presidents, didn't just invoke the Railway Labor Act to, you know, force a contract on the workers. No, he went to Congress and he asked Congress to pass a bill so that he could draft all strikers into the military.
Yeah, I don't know that that would fly today.
No. I mean, and this is, you know, FDR broke strikes too. You know, 1943, the coal miners go out on strike, and FDR, you know, sends in the military to run the coal mines. So, you know, there's a long history of even the most pro-labor presidents intervening in strikes that are seen as counter to the national interest. Now, Truman says in 1946, quote, "This is no longer a dispute between labor and management. It has now become a strike against the government of the United States itself. That kind of strike can never be tolerated. If allowed to continue, the government will break down. Strikes against the government must stop." So putting what Biden's doing into that perspective is a different kind of, I think, leads to at least some conversations about both what Biden's doing and, you know, like maybe we should rethink some of the stories we tell ourselves about our labor history, where in the past Democrats were supposed to have been so pro-labor and then they became big sellouts. You know, the historical record's pretty complicated on this.
Yeah, and one of the first things you said to me is, you know, it's complicated. And I'm going, well, that's not good messaging.
It's not, maybe, but it is complicated. And look, I mean, I don't think that is an excuse or anything for Biden. I wish he hadn't have done that, but I'm not surprised that he did. I mean, you know, I think that one of the stories here is that presidents of both political parties have done this repeatedly. And it's not surprising.
No. Look,
once Biden went beyond his own mediation commission and was able to, you know, force the companies to give up one day of sick leave, which, I mean, is pretty, you know, pretty poor still. It was pretty clear that that was as far as it was probably going to go. So I don't think there's anything surprising here. That's different, though, than excusing it.
No. Look, and I said months ago, this was never going to go to a strike. We were going to end up in a situation like this. My problem is it's the manner in which they went about it. My problem is you know, it's the messaging that comes out of this. Always knew this is where we're going to end up. But it's my view that had he come out and said, had one bill, I want one bill, put those sick days in the bill. If you can ram something down their throat, ram something decent down their throat.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that you're right about that. I mean, I don't think they handled this very well. You know, there is some talk about building on an Obama era executive order that mandated sick leave for federal contracts. The railroads all have federal contracts. That you could extend it that way. I mean, I think that there's a few things here. I mean, one, you're right, the messaging is quite poor. And there may be other methods by which some of this stuff can be accomplished, and perhaps an executive order is that way. But I don't know if that really would counter the kind of messaging that has come out of this. So, yeah, I mean, clearly this could have been handled better, and I wish it had been. And but that's, you know, that's, I guess, water under the bridge at this point to a certain extent.
No, because, look, we have had rail strikes in the past. You know, you think of the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, where literally we're burning things down. No one wants that again. And look, you know, nobody was talking about that. We're talking about a couple of sick days. We're talking about something that is incredibly reasonable. And that's my problem with this. These aren't wild requests and wild demands.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there has to be, you know, I'm really curious to see where we go here, because I'm not, you know, necessarily damning Biden's claims at this point that he's a pro-labor president. I mean, as hard I believe that he is, and I believe that he made a choice based around what he thought was the best move at this given time, and we can debate that. But I do think that there now the onus is on him to find a way to extend this sick leave, right?
Yep.
Whether it is to make sick leave a far more central part of Democratic Party policy than it really ever has been, or has been for a very, very long time, or it's using these executive orders or what. But now the onus is on him because, I mean, you know, if he and Congress are going to intervene and implement a contract that in many ways is a pretty good contract, but on this one issue is quite terrible, then it becomes on them to find another way to fix the problem. And so they need to do that.
No. And again, it's the optics, Eric. It's the messaging that comes out of this. You know, I'm down here in Atlanta, you know, talking to union members about getting out to vote for Raphael Warnock because the Teamsters Union has endorsed Raphael Warnock, saying we need that 51st vote in the Senate. We need more labor voices in the Senate to get some pro-labor legislation moving in the right direction. But as I'm talking to these folks, a lot of UPS people, because UPS is huge here in Atlanta, you've got a lot of people going, well, what's he going to do if we go on strike next summer? That's a natural thought. Now, understand, you know, these are completely different scenarios, different labor laws for different. But the message is he's not letting somebody strike. What's it going to mean to me? And I think that needs to be explained.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that Biden has dug himself a hole here with labor. And he needs to make that up. I mean, I'm hearing from my own sources that not within the rail unions per se, but within AFL-CIO circles that, you know, that it was obvious that there wasn't going to be a strike and that, you know, they support his actions more or less. But that doesn't necessarily message down to the rank and file anyway, who may not trust those union executives. And so, I agree that he's got to now do something, right? He has to make a clear case to working class people that he's going to be on their side, because, you know, to the extent that he had made that case before and backed it up to a certain extent, you know, now, regardless of the complexities of the issue, that has been certainly muddled. And, you know, given that the other side, you know, is fascist, you can't really have a muddled message here because it's just too important.
No, it's an excellent point. But here's my problem. What he did, and we talked about this earlier with David Bohr, he's opened the door to people like Marco Rubio. He's opened the door to people like Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz to say, oh, we care about working people. I mean, again, it's part of that messaging that I'm so concerned about.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody like Josh Hawley was to become the Republican nominee in 2024, I think that there would be a real issue here in the sense, I mean, he, you know, in the vote yesterday, he was one of the only Republicans to vote for the expanded sick leave bill, you know, and he challenges his other Republicans to, you know, say that if the Republicans are going to be a party of working class people, it actually has to do something for working class people. And, you know, I think Josh Hawley is a horrible human being, but you got to give him credit on this because he did do that. The vast majority of Republicans did not. Right. And so, if you were in a situation where somebody who genuinely took these issues seriously and, you know, promoted something like, say, paid sick leave for the American working class while demonizing the Chinese or Mexicans or other things, that could be a very, very, very large threat to Democrats and to Biden. You know, but if it's Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis, probably less so. But now we're getting into the vagaries of, you know, internal Republican politics. But I think that the bigger point and the important one is that the door is open for Republicans to take advantage of this. Whether they can really do that or not, I don't know. But they can certainly at least give some lip service to it.
No. And that's where, again, you look at this and it's just where we are. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Eric Loomis, author of the fabulous book, A History of America in 10 Strikes. Highly suggested. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. But here again, you know, you look at the historical context of this. This isn't as big a deal as some of the past. And again, some of the responses I've gotten from people during the Clinton years, there was another one of these kind of deals, as I understand, where the railroad folks weren't thrilled with it then either. Because my problem then, the messaging keeps coming back to, you know, Democrats keep siding with capital over labor in every one of these scenarios.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, both parties are capitalist parties. I mean, this is, you know, this has been the reality of the system. I mean, workers have always had trouble in breaking through that with some success in the mid 20th century, but only even then a limited success. You know, I mean, I think that in the contemporary political context, it would take a president of pretty unusual bravery to allow this strike to happen. And that doesn't mean that I don't wish Joe Biden had been that person of bravery, but I don't think that's that who that person is. You know, Joe Biden's not a brave politician. You know, he is a kind of a middle of the party, whatever the party stance is, he's kind of in the middle on it. And you know, even if he holds like personally holds labor closer to his heart than other previous Democratic presidents, which I certainly think is true. You know, he's not showing the kind of will to say, you know, we're going to at least let a strike happen for a few days, see what can happen, and then move in that direction, which probably would have been a smarter play. Because at the very least, you know, he might have been able to show that, you know, he really does want this to be worked out between the companies and the railroads without the government getting directly involved, and would have gone, I think, maybe a little bit farther toward convincing workers that he really was on their side. So yeah, I mean, I agree that there were errors here.
No, because you know some of the emails that we've gotten from people, you know, the one as he said, you know, we're basically strangling the baby in the cradle, because now there's this kind of energy through the country where people are starting to say, you know, we need to organize, and you're seeing more strikes, and you're seeing the beginning of a movement. Does this stifle that? I mean, you're the historian. Does this play in any part of history? Do you thoughts?
I don't think it stifles it. I mean, I think that if we're looking as a working class for a president to be our leader, we've already lost the game. You know, the president is going to respond to power. And, you know, it was worker power in the 30s and the massive strike waves of 1934 that forces the National Labor Relations Act. You know, and just as one example, I mean, you know, both Roosevelt and Truman, you know, again, had pretty significant strike breaking events in their presidency. And nonetheless, you know, they also signed some pro-labor legislation and do some good things. And so I think that, you know, if we're waiting on a president to lead us, that's never going to happen. And if our willingness to engage in even the basic first levels of organization is based on, you know, whatever the president's doing in an industry that's pretty far from ours, I'm not sure that we really have the kind of class consciousness that we need and really understanding of the role of workers in American politics to really move forward. So I would say no, historically it really hasn't. The exception to that, of course, is Reagan firing the air traffic controllers in 81. But that's such an extreme action at a particular point in time. And to compare Reagan firing the air traffic controllers to Biden implementing this contract, those are just wildly different scenarios.
No, because the contract, honestly, you know, there's a lot of good in that contract. It's this one provision that, you know, four of the unions, you know, wanted and need. I mean, I come back to this isn't just a want, this is a need. This is a
Because I would argue it's not just a labor rights issue, it's the human rights issue. I mean, we should all have sick leave, right? We should all be able to take a day off without being punished. This I think is a universal truth. And I think there's a number of different ways to accomplish it. And so goes back to, you know, if Biden's not going to allow the strike to fight for this, then what are you going to do? You know, because I think now it becomes on him to figure this out, because the demands are so utterly reasonable here.
Yeah. I keep coming back to this could be, and I still believe the workplace is how we reunite the country. This is how we bring people back to somewhere near the sane line. At least that's my thought.
Well, I mean, I think certainly it has been in the past, and work is one of those things that is kind of universal. I mean, it's one of these life experiences that we all have, and you know, in our society, for better or for worse, and many would argue for worse, work is really central to our identities, but also to our social welfare programs. And so, you know, obviously we need a strong workplace and a strong worker culture in these workplaces. And I think that we are rebuilding that. I think there have been many positive steps that have taken place in these last several years, some of which are related to, you know, DC politics and some of which are not. And I think that we still have to just keep moving ahead. I mean, I think that the larger kind of takeaway here is, even out, you know, setting aside the reasonableness of the demands of the workers, is that if you think you're going to move forward to worker power without setbacks, then like, we're going to be disappointed all the time. There are going to be setbacks. The question is, what do you do when the setbacks happen? And that's where we're at this particular moment.
No, and this is where I've been saying, look, the reality is now we pick the ball up, we move forward, and we demand sick days for everybody. This, yes, to me, is the call forward. You know, everyone now knows, there are people out there who are on call 24/7, 365, fast food workers, railroad workers, truck drivers. That's the reality. Maybe we need to have some comprehensive major labor law reform in this country, and that maybe is the call forward.
Yeah, I mean that clearly needs to happen. And I think that it is notable that in terms of the bill that would have provided the 7 days of sick leave, you know, every Democrat supports it except for Joe Manchin. And, you know, that obviously Manchin is very annoying, and that's very unfortunate. But, you know, you do have a scenario here, despite disappointment with Biden, in which every Democrat but one supports this and every Republican but like two do not support it. And so there's still like a really wide party vision here, which, to go back to your get out the vote stuff with Warnock, you know, electing Warnock is a blow for labor, right? It is a blow to get another pro-labor voice in there, to make sure that pro-labor voice stays in the Senate, to isolate and lessen the influence of Joe Manchin. These are positive things, but is that going to be what wins, you know, new worker rights? Probably not, right? But it's a step at a time. It's moving forward. It's building power. And we can't be, you know, let one setback. And again, like, while we can express outrage over the utter reasonableness of the demands, it's not as if this is an act of union busting. It's not as if Biden has turned on the labor movement here. It's a complex situation in which maybe he didn't make the best choice. But we still are building towards something, and we have to keep our eyes on the prize, even when we do think of something as a setback.
There you go. I appreciate the thoughts, Eric. Great stuff, as always. Appreciate the time. Good stuff. Hope folks will take a look at the book, A History of America in 10 Strikes. We'll get links out where you can take a look at that. Eric Loomis, appreciate the time.
Hey, thank you so much, Rick.
Good stuff. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Any questions, comments? I want to hear it back after this. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Thanks for tuning in to The Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter @RickSmithShow, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at TheRickSmithShow.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, in talking with Eric, this is one of those things where you go, you know, remembering my labor history tour that we did back in 2013, we ended up in Martinsburg, West Virginia, where the claim is the Great Railroad Strike of 1877 began, where they literally burned the roundhouse down. And, you know, nobody's talking about that kind of ruckus strike, burning things down. People are talking about something reasonable. And this is the part that I'm struggling with. And this is the reason, you know, Eric, you know, kind of talking us off the ledge, if you will. But the reality is this is extraordinarily reasonable stuff that every working person has almost taken for granted in this day and age. The idea that, you know, sick days are going to be something that you get, kind of taking that for granted, you know, makes me go, this is why you should have fought the right fight. This was the right fight. You say pick your battles, pick your fights. This was a good one. This was the right one. This was one that the majority of people, right, left, center, could have gotten on board with. This is something that could have united people. And you know, again, you know, as an old timer told me years and years ago, you know, they went on strike every 10 years back in the old days because it got people to feel that they fought for something, that they won something, that they were taking control of something, and they wouldn't give it up. You know, sadly, too much of what we see today, people are willing to bargain away hard-fought battles of the past. This is a battle. This is our battle. This is our moment. This is an opportunity to fight and win something.
The Shaw 101 FM, Brookfield's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
You care for the house, the kids, and our future. Ashiro's day is never done, so let's start saving a little more now. Get free tips to help boost your retirement savings. Visit ashiretirement.org.
Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
We stand on the shoulders of women who came before us.
Women who fought for their own financial futures.
And now it's our turn.
Join us. Visit WeSaySaveIt.org and take control of your financial future by saving for retirement.
A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand.
You hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUS Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Over the years, you've really kept up with the times. You're on social media.
Like, dislike, block.
Maintained your health.
10,000 steps. I'm a beast.
You even programmed your own smart home.
In 10 minutes, remind me that I'm a genius.
In 10 minutes, I'll remind you that you're a genius.
If you can do all that, you can definitely save for retirement. Just go to aceyourretirement.org, a free online tool sponsored by AARP that can help you get on track with your retirement savings no matter your age. At aceyourretirement.org, you'll meet Avo, the friendly digital retirement coach, and in just 3 minutes, get personalized recommendations to help boost your retirement savings. They're easy to understand and work with your lifestyle. It's quick, easy, and free. Plus, it's brought to you by AARP, so you know they got your back.
You are a genius.
Take charge of your retirement. Go to aceyourretirement.org now. That's aceyourretirement.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing. I came out in the 11th grade. Nobody was embracing you. The kids were cruel. It was very difficult to be gay. Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
The hard part was determining that I was going to do it, but I definitely didn't do it alone.
At age 30, with the help of her mentor, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
I have a mentor, Maria. She convinced me to continue my education and to finish what I started to get my diploma. Just never judges. She's a true role model. If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, go get it. You can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
For Civic Media, I'm Terry Bell with this news. It's cold and flu season, all right. Hospital beds and doctors' waiting rooms are filling up around Wisconsin with an uptick in RSV, the flu, and COVID-19. Health officials say the problem's being made worse by staffing shortages. Hospitals and clinics around the country report the same issues. 10 people are charged in connection with a methamphetamine ring in Fond du Lac. Prosecutors say the suspects delivered more than 100 pounds of meth worth more than $1 million this year. 3 more suspects were still on the loose as of yesterday. They're all facing a number of drug charges. In sports, Marquette beat Ball State in the opening round of the college women's volleyball tournament last night. Wisconsin hosts Quinnipiac tonight. Also tonight, the Bucks take on the Lakers. You're listening to The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK 548.
He's a bully, and there's nothing godly about that. Nothing presidential either.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So again, as we've been talking about pretty much all the last couple of days, look, I'm in Georgia to talk about how we get the 51st vote in the Senate to help working people get the legislation they passed. And look, the message out of all of this is still the rail barons are the reason we're in this mess. Biden, yes, screwed this up, but it's the rail barons who could have made this all better, could have simply, easily, virtually cost-free helped these workers get what they need. Instead, no, they're using the law to their favor because they know they can hold the country hostage. And look, like our political system hostage. That's why I've asked Craig Harrington to come talk with us. Craig is one of the wonderful people over at Media Matters, Media Matters for America, the website. Craig, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start right with this situation. I've been beating Biden up pretty badly, and I think he deserves it in this moment. I think there's a better way to go about this. I think there were many more options than what we've gotten. Make the argument that there is a strategy, because I keep hearing there's a strategy down the road. There's be patient. I'm sorry, I'm struggling with the be patient.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that we've seen, just to sort of bring people up to speed for anyone who's trying to sort of get a TikTok of this, back in September, the Biden administration and the Labor Department used their congressional authorization, which I think goes back to 1926, to negotiate a contract, mediate contract negotiations, rather, between railroad management and railroad unions. And they came to an agreement that did have some pretty considerable accomplishments that the union was looking for, but specifically lacked the thing that management was holding out on, which was paid sick leave. And so even though they did have a negotiated contract that would increase pay, and they did have some other ancillary benefits, the big thing that railroad workers were holding out for was having some guarantee of paid sick leave. That wasn't included in the September deal. That deal was rejected by four of the 12 major railroad unions. And now if we don't find some, if Congress wasn't able to overcome the deadlock on those negotiations between now and September or December 9th, there was going to be a strike. So what we saw in the past few days was the Biden administration recognizing the economic damage from a strike would be potentially catastrophic. The Biden administration argued with Congress that they needed to go back to the same authorizations that they have that empowers Congress and the White House to negotiate these deals, and to actually force the acceptance of this measure, essentially breaking the strike that the unions had brought. This didn't go over well with the unions, of course. It also didn't go over well with the media coverage that we saw, you know, how this was framed. It's been exclusively discussed as a failure of Democrats to mediate a compromise between management and labor. Unfortunately, management has gotten off almost completely scot-free. No one is complaining. No one in mainstream or right-wing media are complaining about management refusing to provide paid sick leave to employees. They're only talking about how it was potentially the unions that were going to devastate the economy just in time for Christmas. No one cared about how management was at least 50% as culpable in that potential devastation. And then at the same time, even though it was Republicans who filibustered a provision that was otherwise supported by almost every Democrat in the House and Senate to provide some of the paid sick leave that unions were looking for, Republicans filibustered that. Democrats were unable to overcome that filibuster. And now that loss is redounding on the Democrats, both in the political space and in the media space. Whether or not that's fair is irrelevant. What it is what it is.
No, absolutely. But it was predictable. You know, and before this, when the president came out and said this is what he was asking for, you knew this is where we were going to end up. And you knew that Republicans were going to vote against. There would be a couple that would try and, you know, pretend like they cared about working people. And they would vote knowing it was never going to pass. Holly and Rubio, who have presidential aspirations, they want to pretend like they're pro-worker. The reality is they're not. And this was, in my view, another one of those moments that a failure of Democrats to roll up their sleeves and throw a couple of punches. I personally would have gone with one single bill, made Republicans vote it down and say, here's where we are. Republicans voted against this. And that's how I would have moved it.
Yeah. And of course, one of the issues that Democrats also face is they sort of find themselves in a bind. It's difficult to remember back this far, but earlier in this year, we were facing these wildcat protests, what essentially amounted to industrial sabotage by a small group of truckers who were using their rigs to engage in political protests and to block highways and bridges and to clog up downtowns in capital cities in the United States and in Canada. And Democrats were opposed to that. And so they may have felt that like they had such a so much inertia behind opposing like what was frankly wildcat industrial sabotage and not really a valid worker action a year ago. They may have felt that they didn't have a foot to stand on now going into a potential labor stoppage and strike from railroad workers. But you know, the fact of the matter is that people don't think about things in those sort of nuanced way. And yeah. The way it's covered isn't as nuanced. It isn't filled with the historical context that people would need to make that argument and to understand those patterns. What you said is also perfectly good synopsis. You know, Josh Hawley, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and Mike Braun, the senator from Indiana, who voted in favor of 7 days of paid sick time for unionized railroad workers, they all have presidential aspirations. Mike Braun has actually been very clear about it because he's leaving the Senate to run for governor of Indiana in 2024. He clearly is trying to set himself up for a 2028 run or afterward. And they want to have a big union win. They want to be able to argue that they have one labor area where they have outflanked the president. And whether or not it was a strategy by the Democrats or just a missed opportunity, the fact of the matter remains, they're the ones who are facing the blowback and the pressure in the public for the way this turned out. Unions are, of course, upset about breaking the strike, even though what they did is technically formally authorized and legal for the government to have intervened in the way it did, for Congress and the administration to have done what they did. You know, whether or not it was a strategy by the Democrats that failed to pay off or whether it was a failure of devising a strategy ahead of time, the fact of the matter remains that unionized workers still don't have paid sick leave, though they do have some other benefits that were negotiated in this new contract. And they're going to have those grievances going forward. They're going to demand new contracts and they're going to hold Democrats accountable for the failures of this current process. You know, the long-term effects of that remain to be seen. But the question remains is, was it worth it to do that just to avoid some disruptions at Christmas? That's hard to say. You know, shoppers and consumers are workers too.
Yeah, I see. I think if you had this arrow in the quiver and it was a real threat that they could have pulled the trigger on a strike, I gotta believe, and I do believe, that the rail companies would have at least come to the table with a better option. I called this back in the summer. There was never going to be a strike. I had a listener say, you know, there's going to be a strike. I said, that's not going to happen. They're not going to allow it to happen. They didn't allow it to happen back in 91. They're just not going to allow the railroads to strike. I think they should. I think, you know, this, again, you and I both know, you know, strikes are about public perception and public support as much as they're about anything else. And yeah, let this lay on the table and let the public decide, not do this kind of heavy-handed stuff.
And this is one of the things that we found at Media Matters in our research. Even when union representatives were going into right-wing media spaces that are otherwise virulently opposed to most of the labor movement, you know, in September there was a very telling interview by Newsmax where a labor representative went in and talked about the simple calculus of what they're asking for is a pay raise during a time of inflation and during a time when these are supposedly essential workers who have been doing important grinding work throughout the pandemic and they didn't have a pay raise. So if you're going to recognize them as essential workers, you can recognize them with a bit of a bump in pay. And the right-wing hosts were like nodding along like, oh, that makes sense. And then they said, and then of course, we don't have any paid sick time. And the hosts actually stopped him and they said, well, you don't have, there's no paid time off for illness, nothing, you can't. Like, what do you do if you get the flu? And they said, you go to work or you lose your job. Yep. And the hosts at Newsmax were stunned. People don't tend to understand that the reason that railroad workers don't have paid time off right now is because of a management style that has been adopted over the past few years, really in the past two decades, and really much more so in the past 10 years. A management style that has prioritized profits over people and has prioritized demanding flexibility from workers that management would never provide any reciprocation of.
No. It's this precision scheduled railroading, they yes. call it. And what it and, really is these people, all of these people who work on the trains, they're on call 24/7, 365. Yes. Their lives are not their own. They're it's basically exactly right. just waiting in reserve. And as I said earlier in the show, the reality is, this is what's happened with over years of management, you know, firing workers, you know, by the in mass, thousands of them. They don't have reserves. And this is part of the workers going, we want something reasonable. So even when Newsmax and the right-wing media are going, huh, that sounds reasonable, you go, yeah, this is a winning message. This is the message, as I've been saying for years now. This is how we reunite the country, right and left, because this is the common sense stuff that brings us back to the middle of the road.
Yeah, and of course the precision scheduled railroading, which is the sort of management term for how the industry is organized now. Workers at Walmart or workers who work in fast food industries, they understand this too. It's the on-call scheduling that they face and that they have been organizing against and that they are fighting against. And so I think that actually speaks to where one of the reasons that this has captured America's attention so much more than other relatively comparable labor disputes is that, you know, so many American workers do work in this on-call system that is predatory and frankly unfair and unjust. And that's why they've had so much sympathy. That's why there's been so much media attention. That's why right and mainstream media alike tended to point out that the workers were in the right. The only question was whether or not their demands were worth shutting down a portion of the economy for. But that goes back to an earlier point I made. You know, the people who would otherwise be shopping at Walmart for their Christmas gifts, who might find things are delayed or that prices are elevated, those people work too. And those people have disputes and grievances with their workplaces as well. And they understand, many of them firsthand, the difficulties of on-call scheduling. It seems like there was a debate that could have continued and could have met a crescendo in mainstream and right-wing media that now, unfortunately, just won't be had. The bully pulpit of the White House could have been used for that. Again, there may be a strategic reason for that. We just saw ourselves in the midterms that Joe Biden proved himself to be a pretty capable politician. He's probably better at politicking than me. But in this area, what we're seeing is just negatives resounding for the Democrats right now. And that may change. The media cycle, the news cycle will move on. People tend to have short attention spans for things that don't directly affect them. But the unions, of course, are going to remember this. And that's going to be something that they remind the administration of and that they may actually come to regret just next week. You know, you were talking earlier, you were talking about the efforts you've gone to in Georgia to talk to people and try to motivate people to go out and vote. And, you know, unions are typically a very important get out the vote mechanism for the Democratic Party. And right now they're all really angry. It's probably not an excellent thing to do when you're trying to drive turnout ahead of Tuesday's elections to have a big labor fight.
You think? Because this is the message that I'm getting. You know, we're saying, you know, go out and vote for Raphael Warnock. We need the 51st vote in the Senate because we want to move closer to getting more labor votes. And you know, I get this thrown back at me. Well, this is what Biden did. Well, the reality is, and this is where, Craig, we could have a whole nother discussion about our electoral system and, you know, the makeup of Congress and how, you know, worker voices aren't in the halls of power in the numbers that we need.
Yeah.
You know, the votes just weren't there. And as I started off, the math just didn't add up. And it comes back to us voting for people who don't have workers first and foremost on their minds.
Yeah. And this actually may be something that becomes a bit of a conversation, you know, on Monday and Tuesday of next week. If Raphael Warnock is reelected, the Democrats will have 51 reliable votes in the Senate. But that would also mean that based on the sort of whip counting that we saw in the past few months, it would mean that the Democrats are probably only one vote shy of being able to end the filibuster because they will have a full majority. And we know that Sinema and Manchin were both opposed to changing the filibuster. And if there's just one of them left, you know, Manchin facing re-election in 2024, wanting to actually have some more legislative accomplishments, Sinema facing a very likely primary challenge in 2024, and also in search of legislative accomplishments, we may be one step closer to reforming the filibuster and providing the Senate with an ability to actually move toward compromises that were otherwise lost in this instance. Yeah. And the reason I bring up the filibuster is important. We talked about it just a moment ago, but I want to reiterate it. The reason that railroad workers will not start next week with 7 days of guaranteed paid sick time per year is because one Republican senator filibustered an amendment that would have specifically provided that by amending the new contract. That contract failed in the Senate, and I'm using air quotes very deliberately there. It failed by a 52-43 vote, which means that a clear majority 55% of the voters in attendance. They didn't have all 100 votes for lots of scheduling reasons. 55% of the 95 senators who voted on that voted in favor of the amendment. 55 senators who represent, you know, probably 70% of the actual American populace voted in favor of the amendment, and it still technically lost because it was subject to a filibuster. That's the sort of appalling anti-democratic movements that we see from the Senate that we'll hopefully have an opportunity to move forward on. But there's really only going to be a chance to move that ball forward if, in the coming weeks and months, there's a sustained media conversation about the filibuster.
Yeah, but what's the point now? Because you don't have the House, you're not going to move any decent legislation anyway. I don't see anything happening in the next 2 years, to be honest with you.
Well, the only thing, this is one of the things the media has mostly been focused on, particularly as the Democrats have a technical majority with or without the Georgia Senate race, but they'll have a functional majority with a win in Georgia. The thing that Democrats are going to be able to do is presidential appointees, mostly at the federal judiciary level, but also for, you know, ambassadorial appointments and other administrative appointments. There's a lot of important work that they can still do. But you're right, on the legislative angle, it's not clear that there are going to be enough Republicans across the aisle for anything in the House.
Still no sick days. And I say this could have been a moment where the president came out and said, I want one bill, put those sick days in it, put it for an up or down vote, and let the American people see where each and every representative in our Congress is on this issue. Because it is. It's a common sense, reasonable offer. It's a common sense, reasonable demand, and it's something that should have been put there. But, you know, here's the thing, and this is where, you know, I've had a bunch of people yelling at me going, no, are you going to dump Biden now? You're going to switch parties? You can do all this stuff? No, the reality is I'm not, because I look at the other side. I'm going to push Biden. I'm going to push the Democrats to do better. I'm going to remind them of this so that they learn a lesson from this. But I look at the other side. I'm looking at Trump. I'm looking at Yee. Evidently, we're making Nazis great again.
Yeah. And, you know, this is actually a point that a friend of mine made on Twitter. There was some sort of both sidesism from one of the very serious people who has a six-figure columnist job at one of the legacy newspapers. And on one side, you have like a party that has legitimate disagreements, sometimes finds itself center left, sometimes finds itself center right, sometimes finds itself as part of the labor coalition, sometimes finds itself as part of the management coalition. And on the other side, you have the front runner in the Republican Party had dinner last week with two neo-Nazis, two avowed at that point anti-Semites. And now in the past couple of days, the entertainer formerly known as Kanye West, who now goes by his legal name, Ye, you know, he came out yesterday and went on a multi-hour tirade on an internet TV show broadcast by Alex Jones, and then later on Twitter before he was again suspended by Elon Musk, just avowedly praising Hitler by name directly and Nazis. He said, quote, I love Hitler, and quote, I love Nazis, on multiple occasions. That's not an accident. And this is a guy who is at the very least an ally of the former president who wants to be the next president.
What island do I have left? I mean, one disappoints me quite often, and the other one wants to destroy me completely. So, you know, this is where you fight to take a party and you fight to move them in the right direction. But I got to tell you, mental illness is a serious thing. And I look at Yee and I got to tell you, I think we need help.
You know, there's an interesting conversation. Not only because I'm not a psychiatrist, so I'm not qualified to have a conversation about it. I don't want to have too much of a retrospective psychiatric analysis of his mental health crisis, but it's very clear that a person who would find themselves in that situation, I could imagine in my case, you know, if I were to have my wife, who I adore, leave me and lose custody of my son, who is the, you know, the light in my life. And, you know, if I were to then start doing the things that Kanye did, I would still face consequences for it. And so, like, there might be an explanation for why he is acting the way he is that is psychiatric and behavioral, but there's no exculpatory reasoning for it. There's no excuse for it. You know, if I did those things, I would lose my job too. If I posted the things he posted on Twitter to my modest following, I would be suspended too. And I think one of the things that we're beginning to see, and my team at Media Matters is working on content about this right now, is some of the people who pretend to be sort of free speech absolutists are starting to come out against Elon Musk for his decision to suspend Kanye West last night, or to suspend Ye last night for literally just posting a swastika on Twitter. And they're saying that, like, this was a degradation of free speech, and that Elon Musk has failed to live up to the principles for which he purchased Twitter. But at the end of the day, having free speech is not being free from consequences. And this is something that many people in the media really don't understand about the First Amendment. Ye isn't being fined by the government. He's not being arrested by the government. He isn't being considered for having committed a crime. But he did get fired, and he did lose his job, and he did have his Twitter, and he did have his Twitter account shut down. Those aren't consequences for his free speech. Those are just consequences.
No, you're absolutely right. But Elon, the free speech champion, banning people left and right, because it's the speech he doesn't like, which is very, very interesting to me and going to be interesting to watch. But Craig, as always, I appreciate the time and the thoughts. Good stuff, my friend.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time.
Good stuff. Craig Harrington, he is the research director over there at Media Matters, Media Matters for America. We will get links out on social media how you can check out the things that they do. Gonna take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2009. That was the day that Walmart agreed to pay $40 million to over 87,000 current and former employees in Massachusetts. This was the largest class action settlement in the state's history. The lawsuit, filed in 2001, accused the retail giant of denying workers rest and meal breaks. The company also allegedly refused to pay overtime, manipulated time cards, and required workers to work off the clock for free. In other words, Walmart was accused of wide-scale wage theft. The retail giant decided to settle the case rather than take it to trial. That was not too surprising, since the company had already settled 63 similar federal and state class action wage and hour lawsuits. The total tally Walmart paid out due to wage theft was a whopping $900 million. Under the terms of the Massachusetts agreement, any person who worked for Walmart from August 1995 to the settlement date received a payment between $400 and $2,500. The company was also required to put measures in place to ensure that wage theft stopped. This included a hotline that workers could call anonymously if they were made to skip meal breaks. Walmart also agreed to use a clock-out lockout program that prevents workers from using store cash registers if they are not actually clocked in for work. In an affidavit filed with the settlement, the lead counsel for the employees said the accord dwarfs settlements of similar class actions against Walmart across the country. Not surprisingly, the company has strenuously resisted all efforts by its store employees to join and form unions. Wage theft, not getting paid for all of the hours you actually work, continues to be a major complaint of low-wage workers and is an important issue for today's labor movement. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So I want to end today, because look, I've been beaten up by Biden pretty good, and the Democrats, and look, deserve it. In this moment, they deserve it. The reality is, and the message for me going forward is, this is the moment we need to start saying we need a movement of working people who are going to come together and take over the Democratic Party and continue moving them. Look, there are good Democrats still out there who are fighting for working people every day. There are people who are still out there going, look, we're going to move the ball. We're going to fight for this. This is what we need to continue. For me, it's about math. It's about knowing that, you know what, there aren't enough people in the Senate. There aren't enough people in the Senate who are going to cast that vote to ensure that every working person in this country has a paid sick day. There aren't enough votes. There just aren't. There aren't enough votes to say we've got enough people to pass a piece of legislation to say, yes, we want to have the right to join and form unions, to organize, to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, to raise the minimum wage, to have safe working. We don't have the votes. And that's the sad reality of the moment. And if Biden's guilty of something, it's, well, not reading the cards right, but also the fact that he's a victim of the circumstance in this. And the circumstance, the math, don't have the votes. And this is where voting matters. And this is where I'm hoping that folks in Georgia get out on Tuesday, December 6th, and they cast their ballot. They stand in the lines that unfortunately are going to be there, and they cast the ballot, and they elect Raphael Warnock because need that 51st vote. So much hinges on it. Appreciate you tuning in. Thanks for your thoughts. Look forward to talking to you again next time. Thanks for being here.
You've been listening to
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.